Good morning, everyone. I hope everyone and their families are safe and sound today. My name is Les Ladoc, and I'm the chair of Protect Our Care, and thank you for joining our call. Before I introduce our speakers, Frank Pallone, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and Congressman G.K. Butterfield, vice chair of the Health Subcommittee, let me just say a few words of introduction. Congress is about to begin discussion on the next major COVID bill. And while the first three bills accomplished a tremendous amount for America, they were focused primarily on economic issues. And we at POC believe that the next bill must focus primarily on protecting the health of Americans. And that includes testing, adequate testing for coronavirus and ultimately for coronavirus antibodies, but also guaranteeing that Americans have access to affordable quality care now and in the future. That means strengthening Medicaid and incentivizing Medicaid expansion, allowing the uninsured to obtain affordable coverage on the ACA exchanges, addressing racial disparities in care, which has become unfortunately even more obvious and paramount in this crisis, safeguarding healthcare workers, and ending the Trump administration's efforts to overturn the ACA and the courts, and their efforts to continue to push junk plans that don't cover Americans when they get sick. If the president's successful in overturning the Affordable Care Act in the courts, and the Supreme Court will begin considering this case in early May, 20 million Americans will have their health care ripped away from them, and protections from pre-existing conditions will be taken away from 135 million Americans. Medicaid expansion will be eliminated. And all this will happen right in the middle of this pandemic, and that's unconscionable. And that's before we realize that because of the coronavirus, millions of additional Americans will now have a pre-existing condition and without the ACA's protection, be at the mercy of their insurance companies. Every expert agrees that we cannot reopen the economy until we can contain this virus and all Americans have the health care they need. With that, I'll turn it over to Energy and Commerce Chairman Frank Pallone. Chairman Pallone has served in the United States House of Representatives for three decades, and as chairman during the 111th Congress, he played an instrumental role in authoring and passing the Affordable Care Act, and he's been a leader and a fighter ever since. On April 3rd, he and his a number of his House colleagues and Senate colleagues introduced a set of health care measures that they believe are necessary to protect us going forward. Thank you, Chairman Pallone. I give the mic to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie, and thank you to Protect Our Care for all you do. And, of course, very happy to see my colleague G.K. Butterfield on the phone as well. If I could just build on what you said, Leslie, look, the reason that we passed and had President Obama sign into law the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is for the very reasons you said, which is, you know, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And the goal then and now is to have as many Americans as possible have health insurance to the point where we get as close as we can to 100% coverage. And, you know, what did that mean? Well, it meant that since we traditionally relied on most people, you know, 65, whatever percent getting their health insurance through their job. But at the same time, we knew that a lot of people, you know, could get health insurance through expanded Medicaid if they were low income. And also that there were people who had to access the individual market, either because they didn't get health insurance on the job or because they worked at home and, you know, were self-employed, that they should be able to get good health insurance and affordable health insurance in the marketplace that we set up. I just think that the coronavirus and the pandemic has, you know, kind of made this even all the more important. In other words, the virus shows that we're all in this together. We have to be united in fighting this thing. And so what does that mean? It means we've got to boost up Medicaid as much as possible. We have to understand that more and more people don't get health insurance through their job because they don't have a job. And that's why the ACA enrollment has to be opened up again. So if anything, the pandemic has kind of reinforced the need to do the things we set out to do when we set up the ACA. and the national approach, if you will, to things. So I just wanted to say, in that regard, the most important thing in the next piece of legislation is to expand the free testing that we set forth in the CARES Act to free treatment. And when I say free testing, you know what we did? We said that it didn't matter whether you had insurance, or if you had lousy insurance, or if you had no insurance, we were going to pay for the test. The federal government was going to pay for the test. And people shouldn't hesitate to go to a doctor or go to the hospital if they think they're sick because they don't have insurance or they have a high deductible or a large copay. And so we need to do the same thing with the treatment, because, as you know, if I think that I'm going to have a $20,000 bill in the hospital, because I have COVID-19, then I'm not only not going to want to have, I'm not going to want to have the test, and I'm not going to want to go to the hospital because I'm going to be afraid of the cost. So I stay home, and then I infect everybody. So again, we're all in this together. And so the main priority in this next bill is to say that we're going to have free treatment. It doesn't matter what your insurance is, whether you have no insurance. We're going to cover the treatment. We're going to cover the drugs related to it. And ultimately, of course, we're going to cover the vaccine. So I can't stress enough that that's what we're all about. But beyond that, the other thing that I wanted to say is with regard to the ACA, we also want the next bill to shore up, if you will, the Affordable Care Act. The president wants to eliminate it completely, tried legislatively, he's trying through the courts, and he's making it, he's basically sabotaging it by saying you can sell junk insurance that doesn't include things that you would need for your health care, particularly now with COVID-19. So what we're saying is we want to eliminate junk plans, have to have essential benefits because of what we're facing right now. And we want to look at the tax credits or subsidies, because these insurance companies now are going to put out a lot more expenses, and the hospitals and everybody's going to have a lot more expenses because of the pandemic. And so we expect that insurance premiums are going to go up. So we have to go back and provide larger tax credits, a greater amount of subsidies for people to afford their premiums. And we want to have open enrollment so people can sign up now, at least a 60-day enrollment period, because if you lost your job, you may be eligible for a special enrollment, but there's all kinds of, burdens with that. Or you may have not signed up. You're maybe those 25 million who didn't sign up for health insurance or are uninsured because you were going to take the risk, but now you don't want to take the risk because you might face the virus. So open up the enrollment for anyone for 60 days or whatever. And in addition to that, we want to expand, we want to make it likely for those red states that didn't expand Medicaid to do so, give them 100% federal dollars, bump up the FMAP for regular Medicaid so the federal government pays more, and also with regard to expanding, remember in CARES, we also said that states could enroll people in Medicaid just for the coronavirus regardless of income. Obviously, we'd like to do that for the treatment as well. The only other thing I mentioned, I probably talked too long, is that when you talk about nationalizing, it's really scary what's happening now, and GK, you're saying it too, obviously, where the president is suggesting that he wants to get out of the business or have less of a federal role in the supplies that are going to the states, less of a federal role in the testing, have the states take over that. No. That is not a good idea. We need to have a national testing, tracing, monitoring program to get us back to where we were. We need to have the federal government set up the structure for that and provide the funding for it. We need to do the same thing with the supplies. There should be a czar for the supplies. There should be a chain of command, and the federal government has to continue to play a major role in it. Sure, the states can play their role, but this has got to be coordinated with the testing and the supplies at the federal level, and not have the federal government get out of it. And that we're setting up a framework for that in the next bill as well. So thanks again, Leslie. I as you can see, I talked too long, it's because of my enthusiasm about what we have to do. And thank you for all you're doing. And thank you, GK.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, your passion and deep knowledge of this issue shines through and is so important to getting done what we need to get done. And obviously everything you mentioned really is a priority, and a lot of it, unfortunately, we have to move forward because the president refuses to do his job of protecting the American people the way I know you wish he would, and I know I do. Let me turn it now to Congressman G.K. Butterfield, who also has spent his career as a public servant looking at the impact of healthcare in rural communities, helping veterans, helping people get the healthcare they need. The congressman also serves as the chief deputy whip, the House Democratic leadership, and as I mentioned, he is the vice chair of the subcommittee on health. Thank you, Congressman Butterfield.
Thank you, Leslie, and let me say good morning to all of you and thank Protect Our Care for your advocacy and all that you do for populations all across our great country. You're doing a great work, and what you're doing this morning is just another example of what you do every day, and so thank you so very much. And to my committee chairman, Frank Pallone, Frank does talk a long time, but I tell people all the time when Frank apologizes, there's nothing to apologize for because he has something to say. He has been in the fight for a very long time. Frank and I were on the committee when we passed the Affordable Care Act, and he was a great advocate then and a great advocate now, and I want to thank him publicly for his leadership. I am the vice chair of the subcommittee on health. As such, I've been involved daily. My staff has been involved daily in the great issues facing our country. But this global pandemic, this coronavirus 19, has just devastated communities all across the world, not just in our country, but all across the world. And so it is the responsibility of the federal government to respond and to respond appropriately. President Trump was very slow in responding to the crisis. He knew or should have known of the gravity of this situation, but he did not do anything for a couple of months. But we'll save that debate for another day, but that's where we began. But once the Congress of the United States determined that we were indeed in a pandemic, a global pandemic, the first thing we did was to pass legislation of $8.3 billion. Just to show you how uninformed the president was at the time, he was asking for $2.5 billion, but we appropriated $8.3 billion, which fully funded a robust response to the virus, including vaccine development and support for state and local governments and assistance for some small businesses. And we did that very quickly. A few days later, we passed, and I might say that was on a bipartisan basis. A few days later, we passed H.R. 6201, which was $100 billion, which guarantees free testing and establishes paid leave and enhanced unemployment and food security initiatives. And we increased the FMAP, that's the federal match that we give to the states to enable them to operate the Medicaid program. And very proud of those two pieces of legislation. But then we moved to phase three. Phase three was intended to be more robust and more stimulative in its effect. The Senate came to us on a Saturday night. I remember it so well, with a plan to invest $349 billion into small businesses, and we said to them that wasn't enough. We had to do more. They wanted to invest $500 billion into big businesses, and we said, while that is important, that's not enough. We've got to do more. And so we engaged in very robust discussions over the next few days, and the result of that was a massive bipartisan $2.3 trillion legislation. Yes, it invests in small and large businesses, but it provides $150 billion to our health care delivery systems. It puts $260 billion into unemployment insurance and billions of dollars in direct payments to the American people, and those checks should now be in the bank accounts of most of these. For those who didn't get a direct deposit, the check is in the mail. And so $2.3 trillion has been the amount that we appropriated in what we refer to as phase three. Now, the thing that's most newsworthy right now, I suspect, is what we are doing going forward. As we speak at this very moment, Frank Pallone and our Democratic leadership, we are engaged in negotiations on an emergency supplemental, The negotiations have been going on all week long. The Republican leadership and Secretary Mnuchin, on behalf of the White House, have basically said to us that what we need to do is to appropriate an additional $251 billion in addition to the $349 billion that we put forward for small businesses, because the Small Business Fund has now been obligated. And we've said to Secretary Mnuchin and to the administration and to our Republican friends in the House and Senate that while that is necessary, there are other compelling reasons to be more robust in the next round of appropriations. We've got to do more. We've got to invest another $100 billion into our hospitals and community health centers and health systems. They desperately need resources. I just got off of a telephone call a minute ago with some pastors, and they were telling me about how they fear that the rural hospitals in their community may be closing in the next few days. We've got to provide resources to our hospitals as well as to our businesses, and Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic leadership are demanding that before we appropriate any more money for small businesses, that it must include the health care delivery system as well. We are demanding $150 billion in state and local stabilization funds because our cities and towns and many of our states, their budgets are now challenged. They're underwater. In my district, I have more than 90 towns, and I can tell you that more than half of my towns, their budgets are challenged. And when budgets are challenged, then policymakers have to make some very tough decisions. And the first decision is consideration is to raise taxes, and they certainly don't want to raise taxes. The next consideration is to cut services, and that's where low-income communities will find themselves to be at risk. We want to do more testing in our communities, and I hope we can talk about that. Nancy Pelosi says every day, testing, testing, testing. She's absolutely right. We have a lot of carriers of this virus who are undetected. We must get into at-risk communities, minority communities. We need to get into rural areas, and we need to test. We need to create mobile collection units, mobile vans, if you will, perhaps give those to community health centers so they can get out into vulnerable communities and do testing. We've made some excellent advancements in testing over the last few days. The testing is no longer the deep throat test, and some may still be using it, but now we have saliva tests and other means of testing. We must test, test, test. There's so much more that I could talk about. Hopefully during the Q&A, we can talk about Medicaid and Medicaid expansion and the Fifth Circuit lawsuit that's now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. We are hoping that the court keeps the Affordable Care Act intact because Medicaid is necessary and universal care is also necessary as well. I'm at 7 minutes and I must stop. Thank you very much, Leslie, for allowing me to speak.
No, thank you very much, and I'll be very brief, and then we'll turn it over to questions. I want to just end where the congressman just ended, which is this threat to the Affordable Care Act and to Medicaid expansion that the administration is pushing in the courts and that the Supreme Court will begin to consider just in a few weeks. Now, experts have said that without the ACA in place, the coronavirus's impact would even be more catastrophic, hard as it is to understand that. Striking the individual marketplace and Medicaid expansion would leave 20 million more people uninsured, and that without the ACA, COVID-19 would likely be considered a pre-existing condition, which would mean that insurance companies could deny people coverage or charge them more if they have previously contracted the virus in any way. If those testings conceivably show an antibody, insurance companies could deny people insurance. Plus, evidence shows that severe cases of COVID-19, the people who survive those, will have lingering healthcare consequences that will require, after recovery, ongoing and expensive medical care, as Chairman Pallone mentioned. The healthcare law, the ACA, also imposes strict regulations over what insurance must cover so that it covers treatment and mental health care and those treatments that otherwise insurance companies might try and deny. So these issues of testing, of Medicaid expansion, of stopping the Trump administration's efforts to gut the law when we need it the most are the things that Congress is intending to act on and hopefully with Republican support in the next COVID bill. And with that, let's turn it over to questions. Whitney?
Thanks, Leslie. At this time, if there are questions for our speakers, if you can press *3 on your phone to enter our Q&A queue. Again, that's *3 if you have a question. All right, our first question is going to come from Suzanne Cornwell at Reuters. Suzanne, you are live.
Yes, hi. This is for either Chairman Pallone or Chairman Butterfield, whoever wants to address it. I'm wondering whether you are feeling much pressure from some other Democrats to go ahead and pass the small business aid without any other add-ons. I noticed that, and maybe you even agree with that idea. I noticed that Representative Dean Phillips has put out a statement saying that Congress must cast aside partisan affiliations and pass relief for these companies now. No delay, no excuses. So I'm just wondering if you agree with that idea.
Well, Susan, the problem that I have, and I think a lot of us share on the Democratic side and hopefully the Republican side as well, is that whether it's the SBA or it's the hospital fund, these things, we did them quickly. We wanted to get the money out in the CARES package, but we also have to monitor how they're being spent, and that if, you know, before we go ahead and just, you know, double the money, we want to have some guardrails, okay? And so what I'm saying is, like, with the small business fund, you know, to just send another $250 billion out without saying that, you know, a certain percentage has to go to people who haven't been able to access the funds or very small businesses. I mean, what I'm hearing from my constituents is, you know, if it's sort of this, you know, the concern that people that have the expertise or the know-how to apply for this are getting it, and those tend to be, you know, larger, even though they're small businesses, the larger small businesses, and the little guys are not able to access it. So I think my concern is that, yes, we need another $250 billion, but I don't want it to just go out under the same rules. There's got to be some changes to make sure that the little guy is able to access this, and it's not all going to the larger businesses or companies within that, you know, 500 employee range. And I would say the same thing for the hospital fund. You know, it's not just the small business fund that's running out. The hospital fund is running out too. And also with that first pot of money in the hospital fund that was just based on 2019 Medicare fee-for-service claims, New Jersey, for example, and New York ranked at the very bottom of the 50 states in terms of what they were getting. There was no reference to the number of COVID-19 cases. Well, that's not fair. Now that, you know, the secretary said he's going to change that with the next pot of money. But so far that hasn't happened. And so we need to have, yes, we need to do an extra 250. I'm certainly pushing that has to also include another $100 billion for the hospital fund and the other things that GK mentioned he might want to get into. But we've got to have better guidelines about how this money is spent, because so far I'm not hearing a lot of good things.
Let me also associate myself with those words and add a few of my own. There's no one in Congress, House or Senate, I believe, who would oppose an additional $250 billion going into the Small Business Fund. That is not the issue. The issue is accountability. We don't have the data. We don't know how the first $349 billion was spent. We only know anecdotally what's happening across the country. We're being told that 5% of the applicants have received 30% of the loans, with the average loan for those being $1 million or more. If that is the case, then we need to know it. The SBA needs to give us the data. When we passed this legislation, we intended to include not only small businesses with 500 or less employees, but we intended to include nonprofits. That includes places of worship. And we're getting terrible, disappointing reports that many banks are refusing to even take an application from applicants unless they have a relationship, a pre-existing relationship with the bank. And even if those relationships exist, the banks are trending toward giving loans to those who have credit with the bank to try to keep the entity in place so they can continue to make their loan payments on the other loans. And so we are very concerned about the data, and so no one disagrees with putting $250 billion in additional funding, but we also need the data. We need to know racial minorities and women-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses. We need to find out how they are faring as well in this program. But as the Democratic caucus has said to the administration, we're not going to agree to $250 billion in additional funding for small businesses unless you recognize the urgency and the emergency of our hospitals and community health centers, and we need $100 billion for those as well. State and local governments are struggling. Many communities, many municipalities are going to be underwater. Some are now. In the next few days, they will not be able to service their debt or provide services to their citizens. And so they're going to have to make some tough decisions, either raise taxes or cut services. And I fear that services will be cut to vulnerable populations who need those services the most. And so I agree completely with Mr. Pallone. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. Whitney, next question.
Our next question is going to come from Alex Ruoff at Bloomberg Government. Alex, you're live.
Yeah, thank you. Chairman Pallone, Chairman Butterfield, I was hoping either one of you could address this. A lot of what you guys are talking about in terms of bolstering the Affordable Care Act, you know, boosting up the premium tax credits, you know, those were bills that, you know, were passed earlier this year, but, you know, a lot of Republican leadership have said they're not interested in taking it up. Do you see that as, I mean, a main barrier in getting what you're looking for? Do you think do you have any sign? Has any members from the other side said, oh, you know what, under the pandemic, we may change our minds on this? Or, I mean, have you got any sign that there's any change to that since, you know, you guys have already taken on that, a lot of the Medicaid incentives and, you know, the bolstering of the tax credits?
Well, look, let me say this. You know, I keep using the term ACA, Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. You know, what I'm asking, I guess, is that everyone put aside the ideology and the naming rights, if whatever you want to call it. In other words, I think there is concern on the part of the Republicans, including the President Trump, that a lot of people are losing their insurance, and we have to be concerned about the uninsured. So, for example, when we did the hospital fund initially, I call it that, but it doesn't just include hospitals, for the $100 billion, you know, Secretary Azar said, well, we're going to include the uninsured. So theoretically now, if someone goes to the hospital and is uninsured, they're going to take that money out of the hospital fund to compensate the hospitals for caring for the uninsured. So there is a recognition that people are losing insurance. We have to take care of the uninsured. But I just think they're going about it in the wrong way. They're trying to avoid the ACA. So the president says, well, I don't want to reopen the enrollment period for the ACA, probably because he doesn't like the ACA, but I'll let the hospital fund cover the cost of the uninsured who come to the hospital. Well, I guess what I'm saying is I think there is concern on the part of the president and the GOP for the uninsured, and there should be an ability to translate that into some of the things that I'm asking for. You don't want to call it the ACA, you know, call it whatever you want. But the bottom line is we have to recognize the fact that a lot of people have lost their insurance, that a lot of people are underinsured now because of these junk plans, that premiums are going to go up. And so we have to address it. I'm saying address it by, you know, shoring up the ACA and giving more subsidies and getting rid of the junk plans and opening up the enrollment period. If there's another way to come to a compromise or a consensus on how to do that, fine. But let's put the ideology and the naming aside. I mean, I'm not saying that's an easy thing to do, but I do think there's hope in achieving what we're trying to accomplish here.
All right,
Chairman, I was just going to add one thing on that, if I could. Did you say that was the last question?
That's all the time we have for questions.
Right. Okay. I would just add to exactly to what the congressman said that, you know, the voters spoke loudly about their support for protections for pre-existing conditions in the 2018 midterms. But yet since then, both the president and Republican leadership and most of the rank and file in the House and Senate have continued to try and rip apart the Affordable Care Act and refuse to listen to what their own constituents say they want. And even in this most recent polling on the coronavirus, it's clear that Americans are very worried about their health care and their personal health. So, you know, we hope that the Republican Party will begin to do the right thing on these issues. And as the chairman mentioned on this issue of refusing to open the open enrollment period for people who are uninsured, that solution is unacceptable because it might cover, because of the Congress's work, the COVID testing and diagnosis, but it will not cover all the other follow-on healthcare issues that these people will have. So we hope that they realize that it's time to actually follow their constituents' desires and give them affordable and quality healthcare. And with that, I want to thank both of our speakers for taking time out of listening to their constituents and moving our policies forward to be with us today. And I hope everyone has a safe and enjoyable weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.